This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast with me, Richard Lee.
Me, Sean Kane.
And me, Claire Armistead.
In this episode, Claire talks to Salman Rushdie about Quixote, his Booker longlisted novel inspired by a literary classic that was arguably the first road trip novel, Cervantes' Don Quixote. And we'll look at other recent examples of the genre, if indeed it is a genre, Claire.
Well, I was thinking about this, and I was wondering whether actually Chaucer's Canterbury Tales could possibly qualify for that honour. But
it's poems, isn't it?
Well, it's a series of fables, but it is on the road. It's not really about the road. So if you define road fiction as works in which a journey as a life-changing experience is a central part of the action, then I definitely think Cervantes nails it.
In the 20th century, it became a particularly useful way to deal with the geographical and cultural behemoth of America. Rushdie's Quixote is actually as much a love child of mid-20th century American road movies as of the early 17th century novel, as you discovered, Claire, when he came to the studio.
So, Salman, this is your 14th novel, and you have decided to go back to Don Quixote, or Don Quixote, who you do not style as Quixote, you style as Quixote. Tell us about that, and why do you call him Quixote?
Well, it's the normal French spelling, that's one reason. There's an opera called Don Quixote by Massenet, who, the character in the book, he likes the opera, so he names himself after the French version. But actually, that CH, the sh pronunciation, is very general. In French, he's called Quixote. In Germany, it's pronounced Quixote. In Italian, it's pronounced Quixote. And even in Spanish, in the Spanish of the time of Cervantes, the X would have been pronounced as a sh, not as a h. You know, so Cervantes himself would probably have said Quixote. So anyway, that's a long explanation for something which I just decided because I liked it.
You've updated it. It's an American road novel, is one way of describing it. You could describe it in all sorts of different ways, but let's start with an American road novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's about I've got my own version of an old fool and his younger sidekick. And he's a traveling salesman of pharmaceuticals in the middle of nowhere in middle America, and has formed an impossible attachment to a television talk show host who he obviously has never met and doesn't know, but decides that she's the love of his life. And he is kind of an old duffer, so it's extremely improbable that she would be the love of his life. He sets out on this quest across America in a battered old Chevy Cruze to prove himself worthy of her hand. And that's the shortest way I could put the story, I think.
But it's a story within a story within a story. So you have you, the novelist, inventing a novelist who invents Quixote, who then invents this imaginary son who becomes his Sancho.
Yeah. What can I tell you?
So, that's a very complicated construction.
Not really. The first level of construction is normal. There's always a writer inventing the characters, so that's nothing new. But yes, it's a writer inventing a writer inventing the characters. And actually, I've never really before ever wanted to do that self-conscious thing of writing about writing, writing a book about somebody writing a book. And then I found myself doing it. And for a long time, I wasn't sure if it was a good idea or not. You know? And as I was working on the book, I kind of reserved the right with myself to take it out, you know, if I decided it was just embarrassing or wrong or whatever. So I, for a while, I worked on it in a very kind of provisional way, not fully knowing if both storylines would remain in the book. And then the storylines just started growing into each other. You know, they started merging. They started putting out tentacles, you know, into each other. And then it became interesting to me the way in which they echoed each other and mirrored each other and revealed things about each other. And so in the end, it stayed in. But it was still scary because I knew that for the book to completely work, the storylines had to gradually come closer and closer together until eventually it became clear to the reader that it was the same story. You know, and I didn't know how to do it. I worried a lot about it. I thought, I don't know how to do this. And it's sometimes you feel with a novel that you've got this large, amorphous shape that you're trying to wrestle to the ground, and it wrestles back. And you're not at all convinced that you're going to manage to pin it down. You know, and I felt that with this. And then quite suddenly, out of nowhere, as it were, I thought of how to do it. And that was a moment of relaxation. I thought, okay, now it works.
Well, should we introduce listeners to these characters?
Yes. Well, he's an old man who's watched too much television. So that's probably the first way to think about him.
This is Quichotte, character that the novelist has imagined.
This is Quichotte, who is our Picaro, embarking on his picaresque quest. Chapter 1, Quichotte, an old man, falls in love, embarks on a quest, and becomes a father.
You have these long chapter headings.
It has these long Dickensian chapter headings. What can I do? That's how they came out. There once lived at a series of temporary addresses across the United States of America, a traveling man of Indian origin, advancing years, and retreating mental powers, who, on account of his love for mindless television, had spent far too much of his life in the yellow light of tawdry motel rooms, watching an excess of it, and had suffered a peculiar form of brain damage as a result. He devoured morning shows, daytime shows, late-night talk shows, soaps, situation comedies, lifetime movies, hospital dramas, police series, vampire and zombie serials, the dramas of housewives from Atlanta, New Jersey, Beverly Hills, and New York, the romances and quarrels of hotel fortune princesses and self-styled shahs, the cavortings of individuals made famous by happy nudities, the 15 minutes of fame accorded to young persons with large social media followings on account of their plastic surgery acquisition of a third breast, or their post-rib removal figures that mimicked the impossible shape of the Mattel company's Barbie doll, or even, more simply, their ability to catch giant carp in picturesque settings while wearing only the tiniest of string bikinis, as well as singing competitions, cooking competitions, competitions for business propositions, competitions for business apprenticeships, competitions between remote-controlled monster vehicles, fashion competitions, competitions for the affections of both bachelors and bachelorettes, baseball games, basketball games, football games, wrestling bouts, kickboxing bouts, extreme sports programming, and, of course, beauty contests. He did not watch hockey. For people of his ethnic persuasion and tropical youth, hockey, which in the USA was renamed field hockey, was a game played on grass. To play field hockey on ice was, in his opinion, the absurd equivalent of ice skating on a lawn.
So there we go. We have Quichotte who it's very exuberant. He's sort of exuberantly involved in rubbish culture, isn't he?
Yeah, and I think one of his big differences from his archetype is that he's much more cheerful. You know, Don Quixote is described as the knight of the dolorous countenance. You know, and he's a sad faced sad sack. You know, he's melancholy.
And Don Quixote had been enraptured by romances.
Yes.
But our Quichotte is enraptured by junk television. Yeah. That's quite an interesting distinction.
Well, I just thought that back then in the day, he Cervantes was trying to say that these awful chivalric novels rot the brain, and literally have rotted the brain of his character. So I thought, well, if I was to find a target now, what would it be? You know, and that's how it happened. But yeah, he's more cheerful. You know, he has a nice smile. He's absurdly optimistic, in a way that Don Quixote is not. You know? But he, I would put it like this: that he conceives of this love for this very, very, very famous woman on television, who's probably the most famous woman on television after Oprah Winfrey, and never gives up the idea that he can win her hand, in spite of all the evidence. You know? I like that. I like that he was sweet and smiling and hopeful. You know, and to launch a figure like that into a world which is not particularly sweet and not particularly hopeful, I thought was a good thing. I thought that worked.
There are several. Areas in which this is new for you, one of which is that you're doing it's a journey across America, whereas usually you tend to focus on individual cities. Another is that you're dealing with the diaspora, with immigration, and with really awful racism.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I finished the novel before, The Golden House, I was very aware of the fact that almost the entire novel takes place on Manhattan Island. You know, And I remember saying to myself, time to leave town. And for whatever, I had no idea what the next book would be at that point, but that whatever it was, it should get out of Dodge, as they say. And you know, over the course of 20 years that I've lived in the United States, I actually have been around quite a lot, you know, to a lot of places. And so I felt that I was able to leave town, you know, and convincingly create Middle America, you know, the place which the inhabitants of the great cities on the coasts call the flyover states, because you fly over them.
The red states, which is, of course, the opposite to
yes,
the political.
Yes, it's very difficult coming from England. You have to learn that the political colours are the other way around, that, you know, red is conservative and blue is liberal.
Did you make this road trip yourself?
I was going to. I mean, I thought about it. I thought maybe I should just first map it out and then do it. Rent, you know, fly out to the middle of nowhere and rent a Chevy Cruze and do it. And I actually asked my younger son, Milan, who is now 22, he was 20 then, I said, would he do it with me? And he was up for it, except that, I mean, in a conversation that I actually gave to the characters in the book, he said, are you going to drive? And I said, well, yeah, I'm going to drive. He said, no, I don't think you can. And I said, well, what, you can drive? And he said, oh, can I drive? I said, yeah. He said, okay, then I'm in. So, and I gave a version of that conversation to top characters in the book. But in the end, I didn't do it because I just thought, A, I have actually been around quite a lot and I probably know enough. And B, I want to be able to make it up. I don't want to be tied down to a literal, you know, kind of road journey, of which there are some very good pieces in America. You know, there's William Least Heat Moon's Lost Highways, you know, obviously Kerouac. There's the central section of Lolita, in which Humbert and Lolita take off through motel land. You know, there's Easy Rider. There's any number of things. One of the books that actually really helped me think about it, surprisingly, was Robert Persig's Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which had some sort of anniversary a couple of years ago. And so I found myself looking at it, which I hadn't done since it came out along 30 years ago or something. And I thought, okay, never mind Zen and never mind motorcycle maintenance. But what I really was struck by was the portrait of the father and son relationship, the father and son on a motorbike going across America to try and get to know each other and deepen their relationship. And I thought, well, that's helpful because I wanted to write about Quixot and the son he makes up for himself who comes to life like Pinocchio.
Like Pinocchio, and then we even have a talking cricket in it.
Why would you not? You know, why would you not, if you could, have a talking cricket
who speaks Italian?
Yeah, and that's of course because the original Pinocchio, not the Disney movie, but Carlo Collodi's novel Pinocchio, has a talking cricket, and it's an Italian novel, so the cricket speaks Italian. The cricket is called Grillo Parlante, the talking cricket.
You know. So you have a lot of fun, and part of the fun is playing with different literary traditions. And at one point you have your novelist character, who is a writer of bad spy thrillers, saying there are novels that are about a dinner party, isn't it? You've got Mrs. Dalloway, you've got Ulysses, but this is not a time for...
For dinner parties.
This is a time for... He says this is a time for mysteries. This is a time of blood.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a bit of me that always wanted to be a second-rate spy novelist. And I think I've finally made it.
So you think of this partly as a spy novel, do you?
Well, there's a bit of it that is, because he has been writing spy novels, and he, you know, one of the subplots is he begins to fear that he's kind of become the object of attention for people in the intelligence world that he's been writing about.
So this is in The Outer Carapace, which is the novelist who imagines Quixote, who has his own life, and he has a son as well, who is a terrorist, who's gone disappeared into a cell,
or a
counter-terrorist.
He's a kind of anonymous figure, you know, like a sort of cyber terrorist who gets turned, begins to work for, depends what you call the good guys, really. I mean, which side are the good guys? It's difficult to be sure about that. But yeah, I mean, so you've got this story about this spy novelist trying to write a very different kind of book, and through this different kind of book to face up to the issues of his own life, like his strained relationship with his son, like his broken relationship with his sister, and to write imaginatively versions of those stories, working out, if you like, the problems of his own life through his fiction. And so that's how it is that the two stories mirror each other. That, yes, and I think those family relationships are really the heart of the book, you know, because I wanted to write about different kinds of love. You know, that's to say, romantic love in the novel is represented by Quixote's absurd infatuation, obsession with Miss Salma R., a person whose name differs from mine by one letter. But these other loves, you know, the loves inside families, fathers and sons, brothers and sisters, you know, sometimes strained by distance because of the, as you mentioned, the diaspora, because of the way in which families can be spread across the world and grow away from each other, you know, and sometimes strained by actual real or imagined wrongs done one to the other, and how those issues can be resolved.
This is one of the ways in which the two storylines come together. So there is a point at which he realises that he has invented a scenario for Quixote, which actually existed in his own life.
Yes.
But he didn't know it existed.
Yes,
but he did sort of know, or somehow it was part of his family intelligence and the breakdown of that family.
I think, you know, it's one of the things that happens to writers, that you sometimes invent things before they happen, you know, and then they happen. And I don't know how that happens, but it does happen. So I wanted that to happen to him, that he invents a moment which he then realises is the truth of his own life, except he didn't know.
That ties in the idea of the public mythologization of all these, you know, there are masses of popular culture in this book, but it's also about the mythologization that happens within individual families. So it's an emotional thing and an entertainment thing and a distraction, but it's also an expression of injury.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of the book which deals with injuries that people do to each other and whether those things are forgivable or not. The question of forgiveness, I think, is quite at the heart of the book. And I remember that actually in the Satanic Verses, there's one page in which one of the characters tells another character a story. There's this man and this woman who are very close friends. They've never had a romantic relationship, but they're close friends. And the man gives the woman, as a token of their friendship, a really hideous, cheap glass vase, right, which has no value of its own at all, but it represents their closeness. And then at a later point, they quarrel, and she picks up the glass vase and smashes it, and they never talk again. And then at a later point, she's on her deathbed, and she sends a messenger to see him, and who says that the only person in the world she wants to see is him. And he says she should have thought about that before she smashed the vase. And the question is, which side of that story are you on? I mean, many people would say that he's unreasonable and forgiveness is so important at such a moment. And some people would say, yeah, but there are things you can't forgive.
So in this novel, most people are forgivable, but there is one person who isn't, and that is the benefactor and cousin of Quixote, who is a corrupt doctor, basically, who's peddling drugs.
Dr. Smile.
Dr. Smile. That is touching on the whole problem of addiction. And we did a session in Oxford the other night on the day that the Johnson & Johnson story broke. Mm-hmm. Again, it's another sort of weird thing of fiction presaging.
Yeah, I mean, I've been following this whole opioid thing for some years, really. And yes, it's all suddenly boiling up with the Johnson & Johnson case and with the OxyContin proposal to settle their cases against them for multiple billions of dollars. Actually, interestingly, if you leave the big cities in America, if you go out into this kind of nowhere land, you know, the red states, the problem's much worse there. It's much worse. There are whole communities in which opioid addiction is rife. So given that the novel journeys through those communities, you know, I had to take this on. And then there are some true stories from which it emerges. I mean, there's one particular case of, as it happens, an Indian pharmaceutical entrepreneur who's, I mean, he's in jail now, so we can call him a crook, whose company developed a very powerful opioid spray, which was an under-the-tongue spray of the most powerful of the opioids, which is fentanyl. I mean, fentanyl is the opioid that killed Prince. And of course, under the tongue, it's even more powerful as it gets into your system faster. And this was made specifically for the use of terminal cancer patients, you know, who are suffering from what the medical community calls breakthrough pain, which means unbearable pain. And it's very, very useful for that. It works very well and has a real value. But unfortunately, he's a crook, Dr. Smile, and he decides he needs more money than that. So he starts bribing doctors to prescribe his product, what's called off-label, which means for things that it's not, the label doesn't say it's for. And researching it, the thing that struck me was not that there are crooked entrepreneurs, you know, I mean, that's like saying the sun rises in the morning, you know, but how easy it was for people like Dr. Smile to corrupt the medical profession for sums of money which are not life-changing. Doctors all over the country have and continue to collaborate in this business of prescribing opioid medications to people who don't need them and creating this crisis. So I wanted to get into that.
As well as this, as Big Pharma, I mentioned earlier on this thing of racism, which culminates in half the racists turning into mastodons. How bad is America? I mean, you're turning ordinary people into dinosaurs.
Mastodons.
Mastodons.
Be fair.
They're not dinosaurs, are they? What are they? They're sort of elephants, are they?
They're big. Yeah, they've got big tusks. It's a fairly obvious reference to the great absurdist play Rhinoceros by Eugene Ionesco, in which people turn into rhinoceroses. And I remember when I was a student at Cambridge, I acted in Rhinoceros, and I was one of the people who turned into rhinoceroses. At 19, you know, I didn't understand the play. And I had to say to the director, I said, you know, what's this about? And he rather patiently explained to me that, you know, it's a metaphor, Salman. and that it has to do with fascism. It has to do with Nazism when Ionesco was writing, you know, and it has to do with the terrifying realization that sometimes happens that your neighbors, that people you know, are suddenly turning into something that you don't know and that you don't understand and that is even frightening to you. And I feel that we're in that moment. You know, we're in that moment where this very divided society, where people that you've lived alongside, you know, your children have played together, and suddenly, because of the divisions that arise, you can't speak to each other anymore. It's as if you're a different species. And so I thought that Ionesco might need a rewrite. And I didn't want to use rhinoceroses because he used them already. So I thought mastodons.
You've come to the UK. You've lived in the US now for 20 years. You've arrived in the middle of a constitutional crisis. What is the difference between the two places?
Well, I don't know. Not to wish to offend anybody, but this is a much smaller country. And these are the problems of a small country trying to pretend it's still a big one. You know, a country that hasn't ever got used to the fact that it's no longer a great imperial power, but just a little offshore island. It feels like a little offshore island trying to be king. And it just ain't. You know, at least in America, it is a huge and powerful country, and therefore what happens there is more frightening, you know, because it affects the whole world immediately. On the other hand, it's kind of a nice change to get away from Trump for a week and to have a different lot of problems to think about. Sorry about that.
And going back now from the public to the personal, it's a story sort of at its heart about a man and his son and mm-hmm. their various different interests. You're a father with sons. How personal is this? And you play all those games, like, as you said, Salma is Salmon without an end.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of fun and games in the book, you know. But also, I think, yeah, I mean, I've been the parent of male children for 40 years now, so I have some knowledge of the breed. And I also was an only son in a family. I mean, I had three sisters, but I was the only male child. And I was the eldest, so, you know, in India, of course, that gives you a particular relationship with your father if you're the eldest and only male child. And my relationship with my father was not at all good. Right? It was very strained. As a result, when I had children, I thought it became very important for me not to make his mistakes, if you like. I remember saying to myself, if you're going to make mistakes, make different mistakes. Don't make those ones. So, I mean, I have this double memory out of which the portraits in the book come of one quite bad father-son relationship, you know, and a couple of better ones, you know, and I tried to sort of use the knowledge of both. And yeah, there are two father-son relationships, one in each of the two storylines, and they don't go the same way. I mean, that's one of the things I thought, if they both ended up exactly the same way, it would feel too didactic, you know. You want them to have their own individual human life, and so they mirror each other, they echo each other, but they are different stories.
The thing about Quixote and Sancho is that Quixote has imagined Sancho into being, which in a way we do all sort of imagine. We think we imagine our children into being. But then Sancho becomes real. And you describe this at various points about him going from black and white into colour.
Yeah.
And then at a key moment, he pixelates. But by that stage, you're so invested in the colour of him that it's sort of like a little tragedy, although you know that this is it's like a hologram pixelating, and he's real.
Well, you have to care about him. I mean, I think that's the magic of fiction, isn't it? That you can make people care about people who are absurd surrealist inventions. And I thought, if there's no emotional affect, you know, the story doesn't work. You don't care. You know, you've got to care. Otherwise, as it were, who cares? You know.
So is the emotional center Quixote, or is it Sancho?
You know, it's interesting you say that. A lot of the book's early readers, friends of mine and so on who've read it, have related very strongly to the Sancho character and have said how much they're drawn towards him. So, I don't know. I mean, you tell me.
Because one is the book of a parent and the other is the book of a young person.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, very difficult to try and write from both perspectives. You know, I remember that, like, for example, when I wrote Midnight's Children, which also has a kind of family at its heart, the book is written very much from the child's perspective, looking up at the adult world. Then later on, after I'd had my first son, when I wrote Haroon and the Sea of Stories, I suddenly realized as I was writing it that, oh, my point of view is reversed. You know, I'm now writing from the adult perspective about the child. You know, and it took me by surprise. But I was very conscious of the fact that that had happened. And in this book, I thought, I have to somehow do both. I have to somehow both be the father looking at the son and the son looking at the father.
Mm. I'm going to ask you one last question, and this is a question that came from the audience in Oxford. It's the question that everybody wants to know, which is, you had a terrible experience, obviously, with the Fatwa, which is 30 years ago. You had to be in solitary confinement, more or less, for a very long time. How has that developed you and shaped you as a writer? Would you be a different writer without that?
I don't know, really. I mean, to some degree, because, you know, you have an intense experience of that kind and it goes on for a decade, it's going to leave a mark. It gave me a lot of information which most writers don't have. You know, I mean, I've been in that James Bond building on the Thames a number of times, so I can tell you what it looks like from the inside. And I've met a lot of spies. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to be a second-rate spy novelist, because I actually have in my life met quite a lot of people with 00 prefixes. I know, for example, that the head of intelligence is not called M, but is called C. So, and actually, one of the things that the spy novelist character writes about is this organization called the Five Eyes, which is the intelligence services of this country, America, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And actually, I didn't make that up. That exists.
And there's a lovely running joke about that. Tell us the joke about it.
Well, the joke is that they all suspect each other. You know, although it's a colossally important organization, which is the intelligence sharing source center of the Western world, you know, everybody distrusts the British because their organizations are always full of Russian secret agents. Everybody dislikes the Americans because they can't keep secrets. Everybody dislikes the Canadians because they think they're better than everyone else. Everybody dislikes the Australians because they're Australian. And everybody dislikes the New Zealanders because they never come up with any good ideas. You know, so there's this world of mutual distrust.
So you've offended just about everyone there.
Yeah. I mean, sort of, I think, you know, equal opportunity offense, I think. But, you know, for comic purposes. And I thought that that was useful information that I learned in those years that I can now have fun with. You know? So, but what I do think is that I was very, very determined not to be deflected by the attack on my work from being the kind of writer I wanted to be. You know, I mean, it would have been very easy to write frightened books. It would have been very easy to write revenge books. You know, and I thought both of those would make me the creature of that thing that I didn't want to be the creature of, you know. And I do think that if you knew nothing about my life, if all you had in front of you was this shelf of books and you were to read them chronologically, you wouldn't think something terrible happened to him in 1989. There isn't that break in the flow of the books. The books are on their own journey, you know, like Quichotte, the books are on their cockeyed journey.
And one of the lovely things about it is the sense of fun in it. You've never lost your sense of fun.
Thank you. I mean, I would, yeah, that, I think a sense of fun gets you through a lot. I mean, right now in America, I'm very grateful for late night comedians because their sense of fun helps one deal with what's going on.
Salman Rushdie. Quichotte is published by Jonathan Cape. And we'll be back after a short break with a look at the wide expanses of the road trip novel.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.
Welcome back to the Guardian Books podcast. Earlier, we heard Salman Rushdie telling us about the road trip novels that inspired his book, Quichotte. We thought we'd take a look at how novelists are offering fresh takes on the road trip novel. In fact, Quichotte isn't the only road trip novel on the book along list, is it, Sian?
No. So Valeria Luiselli's Lost Children Archive is another, and it follows a family as they journey from New York down to the US-Mexico border. And there seems to be this particularly American thread of the road trip novel. I don't know why that is. We were talking about it before, talking about this foundational myths of countries, these big countries like America and Australia, and how there seem to be lots of road trip novels.
Even if you look at the very first history of America, it's all about driving your wagons west, isn't it?
It's a culture
founded on the road trip.
You're this myth that there's kind of extra space and you can leave your troubles behind and go and find something in the emptiness out there, even though, of course, it wasn't really empty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, the idea of the individual finding themselves through travel, which is partly about staking out the territory, the geographical territory, which is also staking out the territory of yourself as a grown-up person in a new world.
Yeah, if you're talking like sort of beatnik coming-of-age stuff, if we're going to talk about, everyone always says, On the Road by Jack Kerouac, but let's not talk about On the Road because it's rubbish.
Oh, that's a brave statement.
Nah, it's rubbish. Let's talk about everything
else.
Quite
good about writing about jazz.
Yeah, but even that, I debate. Anyway, I was thinking that actually there's a funny thread in road trip novels, because I was thinking about the great ones that I've loved and then thought, actually, a lot of them are really depressing. They're not always sort of these great records of freedom and getting away from things. There's also things like As I Lie Dying by Faulkner, where they're transporting a corpse across Mississippi. That also got me thinking about Alia Trabuco-Zarand's The Remainder, which was up for the Man Booker International Prize last year, translated by Sophie Hughes, which was about three Chilean students driving a hearse in search of a lost corpse. Going back to an American book, books like Travels with Charlie by John Steinbeck, which I love, and some people don't love because it's Steinbeck writing nonfiction, and you get sort of full glaring Steinbeck being grumpy and kind of hating his own country. It's a really, really good travelogue book, though. He basically packs up his poodle Charlie and they go driving across America. And it's an amazing journey. It was 10,000 miles that they drove in this camper van that he had built for him. And it's sort of post-Pulitzer, so he's used to being recognised and he's kind of annoyed about being famous. And he drives out of Long Island and goes across the Pacific Northwest and then to California and to Texas and then through the Deep South back up to New York.
I mean, that's one of the points about why it's so American, isn't it? Is that it's such a massive country. How else can you come to any conclusions about what it is other than following the roads and seeing all the different parts of it?
Yeah, well, that's kind of why he did it in a way, was to, I mean, partly his son has said that he did it because he knew he was dying, but it was also, he clearly had this urge to get a better sense of the country that he'd been writing about for so long, and perhaps he'd lost touch with a bit because of his fame and his travelling around the world and stuff, so this sort of trip was kind of a last hurrah for him.
But that's a piece of non-fiction, so that's kind of cheating in a way, isn't it? And often the subject of the road trip novel is often not so much the trip itself as the kind of journey the characters are going on as they go along the road. So, I mean, is John Steinbeck writing more about America or more about himself?
I'd say more about America because he doesn't really appear very self-reflective. And he is a massive grump. He basically doesn't get along with anyone on the trip except for Charlie, who's this sort of lovely, placid presence next to him. But I think it's a lovely portrait of a country.
If we would go into nonfiction, then you could talk about, say, Bell's Rings of Saturn, or, you know, I mean, the whole psychogeographic
everything
movement,
that, like,
that Ian Sinclair, full stop.
And things like Bill Bryson and Paul Theroux, and lots of old blokes travelling, basically.
But what about more modern books, Claire? Are there things that are novels, indeed, actually things that are made up that are part of this tradition?
Well, I really enjoyed The Wangs Versus the World, which was a first novel by Jade Chang, who's Chinese-American. And it was sort of around the time of the collapse of real estate and this busted millionaire collecting his kids who, because he could no longer afford their boarding school fees, and driving off across America. She wears very lightly. It's like the opposite to Valeria Luiselli, in that Valeria is very solemn and attentive in a very solemn way, and Jade is sort of, it's this riotous journey across America. It's a sort of hoot in a quite a Rushdie-ish way, in a way.
And there's also like an American author, but not set in America, Jonathan Safran Foer, and Everything is Illuminated, which follows in the modern parts of the novel, a trip across the Ukraine. Again, that's quite zany in a way because of the tone of the narrator being this young Ukrainian translator whose English isn't quite up to scratch.
In terms of countries, I mean, we were having an argument about how much the size of the country counts, and I made the heretical claim that Ukraine was no bigger than the UK, and actually you proved to me, Sian, on your phone.
Just with a Google Maps.
That it was.
It's quite
However,
big.
I mean, I do think that it's something that it's particularly valuable for big countries, and you're Australian. There's some very good Australian road novels, aren't there?
Yeah, well, you and me both talking about Peter Carey's A Long Way From Home, which was his most recent novel, we both kind of feel was
Terribly underrated, I think.
Yeah.
It's a really good novel. And that's based on the Redux reliability trials in the 1950s, where it was a car manufacturers who started this road race around Australia. But then it becomes a meditation on what is Australia and what are Australians. But you also have this vision of the outback littered with old car carcasses. You think, that's such an extraordinary image, which I will carry forward with me, just as I carried forward Peter Carey's earlier image of the cathedral being rowed down the river in Oscar and Lucinda. It's got this brilliant image-making ability.
Yeah, another example I only recently read, but is quite a famous book in Australia because it's now a syllabus text, is Swallow the Air by Tara June Winch, who's a young Indigenous author. Again, that follows an Indigenous teen who sets off to find her father and also get a better sense of her cultural heritage. That's also an element in the Peter Carey as well, is this thread of Indigenous history and also these divides between rural communities and metropolitan communities. And it's like a shorthand, the road trip novel, for looking at those divides as you sort of pass through towns into cities, back into towns.
And in the Kerry, it ends with this cave painted with Aboriginal road maps. And what he's suggesting is actually there are two totally different ways of mapping a country. You know, he's just going on this journey. You could say it as a sort of parallel or ghost or shadow journey of journeys that have been taken by people before, mm-hmm. but seeing a completely different landscape. Yeah. And that in the end is an elaboration on the road trip. It's something I've never read. And I do think it belongs to the genre and extends the genre.
What about closer to home? Are there any Brits on this crowded island?
Well, Britain is so small. And I do think that it's quite a sort of dwarfish genre in England. I mean, the obvious one that comes to mind the most obvious one is Neil Gaiman's Good Omens, Sian. You're a huge Neil Gaiman fan, aren't you?
This is actually the first example that came to me, maybe because of the recent TV adaptation. But you've got a hellish Bentley that's driven around by an angel and a demon, and they're trying to stop the apocalypse from happening. So they get into this Bentley and head to Lower Tadfield in Oxfordshire to try and find the Antichrist, who was a young boy living in this Oxfordshire village. It's just got sort of all these elements of, like, it was how, as like a young Australian teenager with no real awareness of English geography, learnt about the M25, for example, and the four horsemen of the apocalypse are all riding motorbikes. There's a lot of movement in this novel, so I think it's a good example.
It is, and you'd call that a road trip novel.
Yeah.
I mean, likewise, Ali Smith's Spring, I mean, where they get into an old coffee van and head up for the battlefield of Culloden, and that becomes a sort of reflection on the relationship between England and Scotland in these very troubled times. But I was struck by how often it sort of heads off into the supernatural. A shining example of that is Michel Faber's Under the Skin, in which an alien serial killer curb crawler does horrible things to male muscled hitchhikers.
Driving around a van, picking up dudes.
He's Me Too before Me Too was even dreamed of.
There's also supernatural or magical fiction, or superheroes if you want to have it, in Laddie Hubbard's The Talented Ribkins, a novel where she sets off through some of Florida's less glamorous locations on kind of family history with Johnny Ribkins and his 13-year-old niece go and dig up treasure to try and pay off a debt. Another great road trip novel, but on quite a small canvas because it's all within Florida.
Well, it's like Sing Unburied Sing as well, which has got a fantastical element to it because it's got this sort of thread of ghosts that pop up and narrate parts of it. But that's set just in the state of Mississippi and follows a family as they leave their home to go pick up the father, the patriarch of the family unit, as he's released from prison, and they go to collect him. I quite like the idea. We were talking about whether the road as well is too obvious an example of road
McCarthy
trip.
Well,
we decided that the shopping trolley counts as a vehicle. The shopping trolley that this father and son are pushing across America after the apocalypse has happened. I think that counts.
Well, so now here was our theory, that there is a little subgenre which is post-apocalyptic road novels.
Yeah, when the roads aren't really roads anymore.
They've
got lots of potholes.
With the road and Emily St. John Mandel Station 11, Richard, you're a fan of her,
yes, aren't you? She came in to talk to us a little while back when it was published. I mean, but it's actually, strictly speaking, it's a post-apocalyptic novel because it's set about 20 years after the disaster when things are kind of beginning to take off. And actually, she follows a troupe of actors and musicians who are trying to get beyond the just day-to-day grind of living by touring Shakespeare around the country.
This discussion, I think, has been slightly outrageous in that we've bent and borrowed and twisted the road genre to our purposes. But hey, that's what literary chat is all about, isn't it?
And that's all for this week's podcast. Next week we'll take a look at the memoir in the company of the writers Laura Cumming and Rick Semada. And as always, do contact us on Twitter at Guardian Books or leave a comment on the podcast page. And do subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts. But for now, from me, Richard Lee,
me, Sian Kane,
and me, Claire Armistead,
and from our producer Ian Chambers, thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. but as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.